Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the podcast. I've decided to make the intros a lot shorter so that we can get into the juicy part of the podcast where the guest tells all about themselves, who they are, or if you're listening to the bite-sized option, you can just dive on in to the miracle or magical moment. And so with that, here's Dave Letterfly Noterer. And kind of why I fell in love with Dave is that he's a raconteur. He's a born storyteller, and he's someone who's lived an absolute authentic life of adventure. I mean, all you have to say is that I ran away to join the circus, and you've kind of hooked me. So without further ado, here's my conversation with this most amazing storyteller.
This lady brought me a big carnival trailer that she served ice cream and fruit cups, you know, sundaes and stuff. And she wanted this big elaborate scene, like a sidewalk scene. And she brought, and I did an absolutely beautiful mural on the face of this thing. And a couple of days later, she called me and said, "Hey, you know, the little spike that sticks out on the top of an umbrella?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Well, you forgot to paint one of them." So I went, "Oh, no." Welcome, everybody. I'm so glad you're here. My name is Dave. Dave Letterfly Noterer. I was born in the Midwest, the son of an opera singer for a mother and a Lutheran minister for a father. So I was a preacher's kid. So yeah, I grew up on a university campus, and my older brother exhibited bizarre behavior for which there was no explanation for back in the 1950s. The only thing I knew was it was a very, very frustrating thing to be going on in my family. And so my response to that dynamic was to withdraw, and I became reclusive and creative. It's part of what ended up making me great, but I didn't develop normal social skills as a child. So I became creative, artistic, and building things and making things. And it's just established my way of going for my entire life. By the time I was a teenager, I had figured out my family was the problem. The solution would be for me to go join the circus. So I did. I took my drums and some of my paintbrushes, and I joined the circus. I played the drums in the band. I would accent the efforts of the performers while they were doing their acts with drum rolls and rim shots and cymbal crashes and all that stuff. And then between shows, I would take my paintbrushes and some paint, and I would experiment with decorating flourishes on the circus trucks. And so I've always been all about applying myself creatively, no matter where I am. I fell in love with horses while I was on the circus. It was fascinating watching what these animal trainers could get their animals to do. And I became fascinated with that. And the next thing you know, I am understudying an old cowboy who knew how to train Liberty horses. And I had a 6-pony Liberty act on the road for most of the 1970s. And then I graduated and had a horse that would lay down and sit up and march and all that stuff. And then developed my sign painting skills the whole time, because I credit the ponies for making me into an excellent sign painter, because they kept eating. So I had to keep earning. So, yeah. And so I enjoyed traveling the country, performing in front of people, and being creative in multiple kinds of things, living an interesting life, making people happy with what I do. And I've been doing it ever since, even though I've evolved. About every 10 years, I've evolved.
I'd love to ask you, how did your parents meet?
Meet?
Yeah. Because I'm thinking of, you know, an opera singer who probably travels and is on stages and performing. And then your father, who's a preacher, how did they meet?
Well, they met after World War II. You know, everybody was busy during World War II.
Yeah.
So my parents didn't meet until almost when they were almost 30 years old. So and my mother was in a quartet at the time, and they were going to perform at a some kind of celebration. It was at a church where there was a mortgage burning celebration or something. And there was a young intern. My dad went to seminary after World War II. He was in the Army Air Corps, and he illustrated flight manuals during World War II. So he was creative and artistic too. And so they met. He was an intern pastor at this event that my mother and her quartet sang at. And so, and then there was a party afterwards. All three of the other women in the quartet were married. My mother was the only unmarried one. And my dad needed a ride to the after celebration party. And so my mother had a car. So it was interesting. The other three girls sat in the front of the car, so my mom and my dad could sit in the back together on the way to the party.
Oh, I love that. Oh my goodness.
That's how they met. Yeah.
Yeah. And they, as they say, the rest is history.
That's right. Yeah.
Can I ask you, you know, upon reflection or looking back at what was going on with your brother, with the strides that we've made in medicine and psychotherapy and everything, would they today be able to diagnose him?
Oh, yeah. He was diagnosed when he was 40 years old. They had isolated what was going on. And he has a high functioning form of autism known as Asperger's. He's a brilliant guy, but he's got no common sense, and he's got no social understanding in regards to, you know, how to get along with everybody else. And all I knew was that it was frustrating, and he was the target of all the bullies in the neighborhood. So, you know, all I knew, it was frustrating. And, he was a target, you know, which wasn't fair. So I ended up growing up with a feeling that something is just not fair here.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah. I turned my back on all that stuff and went out and proceeded to live an interesting life.
I'd have to say yes to that. I mean, first of all, when I was a kid, I always dreamt about running off with the circus, but the circus never came to my town. So I never had that opportunity. So I just commend you and your spirit for just saying, this is it. This is what I'm doing. I mean, was it nerve-wracking to make that decision?
Not at all. No, I was on fire. I was motivated. I was filled with zeal, excitement. I just wanted to fit in somewhere. It was sort of like in my family, because of all that frustration, maybe the issue was I didn't feel like I belonged. And the circus gave me a place where I could belong. I could be who I am, as you know, and apply my creative skills in multiple areas. And they appreciated that. And it gave me a way to fit in.
Do you feel like a lot of the people who were at the circus, you know, did they feel like they also didn't belong in their various communities, and finding the circus helped them to find their community? Does that make sense?
I'm not sure about the typical one. It's a very, very interesting culture. And there are families, multiple generations of families that pass along their skills and talents on to the next generation. So those aren't necessarily people who don't feel like they fit in. They fit in great. And they are the elite of the culture, you know, because of the secrets that are handed down from generation to generation.
How long in total did you travel with the circus?
Pretty much the entire decade of the 70s, and then it tapered off, and I didn't perform as intensely during the 80s because my sign painting career was taking off.
Okay.
Yeah, and so but I still performed intermittently whenever I there was an opportunity. And I performed all the way, the very last year that I performed, and that was with my third horse and I had a little mule that I did a comedy act with, and our lives started together in the late 80s, and we performed all the way. The very last time we performed was 1996.
Wow.
And there are videos of the mule act and the horse act on YouTube that you can go look at if you'd like. It's all in my library. Just find Letter Fly and you'll find all kinds of different things to look at.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited. I think you just kind of solved what I'm going to be doing with my Friday night. So thank you, Dave.
Okay.
You know, when you were a kid, you know, and you're in this household, this creative household, and you have your brother there who's, you know, people don't understand who he is. He's struggling. I mean, what did you dream about becoming? You know, did you dream about becoming an astronaut or a football player? What kind of dreams did you have as a kid?
Well, when I was a little kid, when I was a tyke, my mother took us to the circus. And when we first walked onto the lot, and I saw the tents and I saw the flags and I smelled the elephants and I smelled the popcorn and we were just walking onto the fairgrounds. My mother leaned down and said, "Your dad would love this." And I was sold on the spot because my dad loved the circus. It was a big part of his annual tradition when he was a child, when the circus came to Columbus, Ohio every summer. It was a big deal. And so I was imprinted with his love for the circus. So when I was a child, you know, other kids would play with trucks and, well, mine were circus trucks. And I ended up building an actual model circus that worked, because I would go and observe how they put the tents up and down and the way the seats and everything worked. And I would build it in miniature and they would load on my little trucks and I would play circus on the floor when I was a little kid. So I suppose I was dreaming of the day when I would be with the circus, even when I was a little kid. So it might have been destiny, you know?
Yeah.
Because see, now that I'm at this point in my life and I'm reflecting on what I went through and the growth that occurred as the result of going through the challenges and transforming those challenges into opportunities, there was an awful lot going on that I can't take credit for. You know, it's like I have to be grateful for the divine guidance that was occurring, even though I wasn't maybe noticing it at the time. And now that I'm writing memoirs of all of these exciting things, these interesting things that I went through, I can see a thread that goes throughout the tapestry that I really can't take credit for. And I believe that. I realize that now, that God's presence was guiding me the entire time. for a greater purpose. And here I am in the golden years, and I'm writing inspirational stories about these events that took place in my life for the sake of inspiring the reader. And it's like, wow, that's my purpose. That was the reason I went through all that stuff, so that my experience could benefit somebody else.
Beautiful. Yes, I was thinking, you know, I've interviewed over 300 people for my podcast, and you might be the only person as a child, your dream of what you wanted to do, you actually lived into it, to be honest.
Uh-huh.
That's kind of astonishing.
Well, you know, it's like my life it's like, you know, when we're children, we're all artists. We all play, you know, we're all curious. We're all on the lookout for stuff. We're not. And then something happens along the way, and a lot of people sell out and do something practical because, you know, after all, you know, that's a kind of a crazy dream that you got there. You're going to be better off if you do something practical. And then you end up in a role that sometimes turns into drudgery, and they begin to resent the life that they have, which is kind of unhappy, which, you know, it's not, you know, that makes me sad that people would be living a life that they don't love. And one of the things that Jesus said was that in order to enter into the kingdom, which is that peace and serenity, joy, inspiration, all of the things that drive a creative person, or should, you know, probably drive everybody, is you have to adopt the mindset or the attitude of a child, which that's being playful and being curious and being on the lookout for things. And you're certainly not being judgmental or superior or having to impress the Joneses or any of those other things. It's just simply being like a child, being curious. And I don't know if I intended to be that way my whole life, but I guess I have been. And even today, I still live that way. You know, the opportunities come and it's like, wow, that would be fun. You know, let's do that. Yeah, that'd be great. Super. Yeah.
Yeah. I have to say that I've noticed that a lot, or most, I guess I should say, highly creative people are intensely curious.
Mm-hmm.
It's as if the two are inextricably wound around each other, and uh-huh. You need both of them to be successful. But also I think it's a huge gift to be enchanted with the world and curious about it. And mm-hmm. I think sometimes people are born with that. It's innate. Uh-huh. Other times I've met people who are not curious about anything and they don't care. And I think to myself, how are you living in this world? I don't understand.
Yeah. Yep.
I don't get it. There's something really powerful and really beautiful about, you know, your childlike spirit, your curiosity, your creativity, and you've kind of fostered that playful spirit throughout your entire life. And I think when you have a playful spirit, you tend to be more comfortable with taking chances and living a life that I call authentic. You know, because your spirit, your soul, your heart knows that if you choose a path that isn't going to feed you, that you will wither, you know? Right. I mean, so when I hear you talking and I witness you and appreciate who you are, I think, oh my gosh, he has superpowers. You know, he's playful, he's authentic, he's creative. And that has made all the difference, as Robert Frost would say.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean,
It also can be stressful when the rest of society doesn't understand your choices.
Well, you know, the thing that's interesting, that there's a lot of social engineering that's taking place with society. And it's just like what we were talked about earlier, about there's a point where the child sells out and he's encouraged to do something practical.
Yeah.
They're not given both stories. You know, they're just given one story, and then they're encouraged to rely on that. But if you would, if you give the child both stories, you know, here's the, be practical and enter into a life of, you know, a regular routine that you can count on, and you'll get thus, thus, and thus. Or you can become a creative with a kind of a gambling mindset, willing to take a chance, you know, bet it all, do or die, and grab the gusto. You might fail and you might have to pick yourself up off the ground a few times, but you're going to learn something that you're not going to learn in the drudgery routine. As the result of going through that, and as the result of that, you'll have a wisdom. You'll acquire a wisdom that will not be available in the safety of that routine. So, yeah, if the child was given both scenarios and then encouraged to select one or the other, or maybe both, you know, maybe there's a way to live a life that you love and be practical and safe. I think that if we, like you said, if we remain curious, you know, what can I do to make my job, to make the day at the office more fun for everybody here? What can I do? And be creative. So there's lots of ways that we could apply the playful attitude that Jesus encouraged us to have. And the payoff would be that we get to live a life we love.
Yes. Yes. I have to tell you, I'm going to mispronounce this woefully. So please be kind, because I have a question.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, you've talked about, you know, your work with horses, your work with that mule, the comedy kind of set with the mule. And I just want to know. So you have on your page, it says, grasping the art form of the haute école, which that I'm saying that wrong, I'm sure, meaning a horse schooled to the highest level. Now, is that a horse for the circus? Is it a horse for, you know, doing a traveling show somewhere else or competing in events? And you can correct my pronunciation. Please feel free.
I'd be happy to. It's haute école, and it's a different language. I think it's, is that German or French or something?
Maybe French.
Haute,
yeah.
Haute école. Haute meaning high. École meaning school. And so that's the, when horse people talk, and this goes back for centuries, you know, back horsemanship was considered an appropriate behavior for the royal court. You know, all of the people who were accompanied the king and the queen, you know, the dukes and all of them people, well, they had different activities, and horsemanship was considered an appropriate activity for the royalty to be involved in. And so there were lots of things you could do with a horse. You could ride a horse, you could hook it to a buggy or a carriage or a something and drive a team, or you could do what they call the high school. And that's the horse schooled to the highest level. And those horses would do what they call the advanced movements, you know, the travers and the renvers and then the passage and the piaf and a lot of the advanced movements. So that's not exclusive to just the circus, because you'll find high school things taking place with Olympic dressage teams and stuff. Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Yes, because a few months ago, maybe 6 months ago, I went for an interview to be an administrative assistant at this business in Santa Fe where they used, it was equine therapy. So I'd be managing the, the office and they had about, we went into this one area and I think there were about 12 horses in that area. And she said, so how do you feel about, just sitting in here with the chairs around all the horses? And I said, that's fine. So we, schlepped our folding chairs in there. We all sat down inside this corral and the horses were just kind of moving around and hanging out. And they had a really metaphysical view of the horses. And, I think they were saying, we'll find out who you really are if the horses, if they like you. And so it was a 2-hour interview. I've never had that kind of interview. And near the end, the horse that I kind of had noticed was the Trickster. And we talked about him because he was just kind of causing a little bit of friction and mayhem, trotting around that and kind of nipping at the other horses, just kind of like the little brother who's just annoying everybody.
Yeah.
And I was just sitting there and all of a sudden he just came from behind me and put his head on my shoulder. And he was so silent. And so I did not even hear him come up behind me. And he just put his head on my shoulder and touched me. And I thought, I was like, what just happened? And then I turned around and I thought, oh, it's you, little Trickster. You're so funny. But I think, eventually during our conversation, interestingly enough, about four horses formed a circle around us and they just stood in this circle, which is really fascinating. I'd never seen, I don't even know what it means, but I sort of hoped or felt that they approved of me. I hope.
Uh-huh. Yeah, definitely. Yep.
But they seem to be very wise and intelligent creatures. And I kind of hope that humanity or humankind is good enough for them. That's all I have to say.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah. There's a lot that's therapeutic about a horse. And I remember earlier on, I mentioned as a child, I withdrew from society. Mm-hmm. Horses for me were a godsend. Because that was the first, that was what I call relationship 101. When I entered into a functional relationship with another living being was with horses. That's where I learned to be functional and honest and consistent and all of those things that that make us socially appropriate. For me, it was with horses first, and then a little bit at a time, I became a people person, partly because of the trade I adopted as a sign painter. I needed a constant stream of customers, so I had to be appropriate, and I had the background as a showman, so I was able to certainly pitch my idea or things like that. And then part of my story includes recovery from alcoholism. And part of the process includes not only doing the inventory work in regards to a moral inventory, where we inventory the events that took place, the people that were in our lives, and the beliefs that we acquired along the way, and a lot of things that needed to be overhauled because it had taken, that aggregate took me to my bottom. So it all had to be looked at. And that's not only where my writing began, but that's where the transformation took place. Because see, I was not impressed when I was a preacher's kid. The stuff that was going on at church didn't make sense to me. All of those hypocrites and all those mean kids who were picking on my brother, I didn't want to have. And my dad, he was being strict. And then the other people at the church, they were disappointed in me because I couldn't walk on water and I was the preacher's kid, So I didn't find a practical relationship with God until I found AA. I entered into the embryonic level of being in relationship with horses. And then it was, it's like perfect. It was the perfect segue to take me into finding a practical relationship with God through the recovery process. So yeah, definitely. So, and today I have a one-on-one practical relationship with God that, that has given me a completely different life, a whole design for living my life.
You're so prescient because, you know, you're already kind of answering my second question, which is, you know, did you grow up in a religious household? We know that you did. We know that you did. And it sounds like you've given a little background on what that looked like, you know, as a kid to be, you know, you're in a church where your father is the preacher, the pastor, the minister to the flock. I mean, it doesn't sound like it was pleasant. And the number of people who have come onto the show and talked about, even kids are so in tune and so smart. And the amount of people who as children just sense the hypocrisy and sensed the, you know, well, look, they say this, but then they don't live into it. Like they're not living into it. And that is tough as a kid. It is so hard to be told one thing and then see everyone else do something different. It is, it can be heartbreaking.
That's right.
I mean, there's, yeah. And that kind of thing kind of can scar you for quite a while. So, you know, would you say that, you know, you were surrounded by this, you're in this milieu at the church and you're sensing the hypocrisy and how people aren't living into what they say they're going to do. And then, and did that push you away from the church or away from?
Yeah. I was what you'd call damaged by the church.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And then it sounds like you kind of went your own way until you experienced AA, and that kind of facilitated a new relationship.
It's kind of interesting. You say I kind of went my own way. I'm a creative person. I created my own spiritual analogy.
In
response to turning my back on the church. And interestingly enough, my analogy had me at the center of the universe. So it wasn't a perfect one, but it was a, it was mine, you know, until I had to, you know, until I hit bottom and had to look at things and become introduced to what I had, you know, how I'd shot myself in the foot and adopt a whole new paradigm. Yeah.
Dave, I'm enjoying our conversation so much that I have to tell you that you're at the center of my universe right now. And you might be even after this conversation is over because you're so delightful.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so what was that like? Because, I mean, now let's go forward in time and you're in AA, you're rediscovering this relationship with God. It sounds like to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that at some point after this relationship is coming about again and being fostered, that you looked, did you look back on your life and your travels and your adventures and how things worked out for you? Did you look back and think, oh, I see the hand of the divine in this?
Yeah, definitely. That's exactly what started to occur whenever I started doing what they call the inventory work. And I started to do the journaling and the writing. And that's where I saw that that thread that was going through my entire life, that was taking me to a place like it was all, I was like destined to live this incredible life for a purpose. You know, I was given a mission. And then there are actually people who are more on a metaphysical level that that credit the fact that we select, you know, our soul selected this particular lifespan in order to come and learn specific lessons. in order for the growth of the soul. And then even, even accept hardship as part of the what's required for the growth of the soul. So that would explain why I was born into a family with a with the with an older brother who produced frustrating behavior, because my soul had gone, well, yeah, I'll take that one, you know, as long as I get to join the circus, I'll go. So and what's interesting, and I was just talking about this yesterday, the next book that I've written, it's pretty much about my third horse. It take the reader through when I had landed in sobriety. I landed in sobriety. I had lost the previous horse. I was in early sobriety, and God saw fit to put another horse in my life. I was gifted a horse and an opportunity to work with an incredible riding instructor in Michigan at the same time. And it was like, I can't not acknowledge God for choreographing that. And then in the book, I take the reader through me acquiring the young horse who's scared. I take him away from his mother, put him in his first stall. He's scared to death. And then I walk him through the training process, you know, over the course of several months. We ground drive and lunge, and he learns things. And then pretty soon I'm on him, and then we're doing some of the advanced stuff. And in a year and a half, I've got him trained, and it's time for me to begin performing with him at the circus. And we do, and he's scared to death. And here I am, I'm being the calming influence in the relationship. And then we go through our entire career together, and we win the award at the Sarasota talent competition, and we perform in Kentucky and up in Quebec and different places and stuff. And then my career as an artist takes off again, because I'm in the right place at the right time. Happy accident, serendipity, let's, you know. And so that takes off. So gradually my horse becomes more of a hobby. And then, like I mentioned, the last time we performed with the circus was in 96. And then the years go by. My career as a mural artist has taken off, and my horse becomes a lawn ornament. And then in later years, he develops a problem in his feet. And then it finally gets to the point where I have to put him down, and I take the reader through that process. And then at the end of the book, it's like, you know, we're in part of the theme of the book has to do with belonging. And that's the thing that the horse and I discovered together was connection and trust and love and all of these kinds of things. And I was explaining the book to somebody yesterday, and that's when it occurred to me that, see, that horse taught me things about because he was scared at the beginning. But then we became connected. He trusted me, and he would go with me all kinds of scary places. He'd go, "Oh, you want to go? Yeah, we can do that," you know. And it occurred to me that that is exactly the kind of relationship that I found with God. Because at the beginning, I was the scared little boy. And then a little bit at a time, I learned to go ahead and trust and obey and be compliant and remain connected and things. So, and I think that my relationship with God was probably introduced first through this relationship that I found with this horse. which is like, wow, what a wonderful thing that is to realize.
God, how beautiful, and what an incredible gift you two gave to each other. Mm-hmm. You know, a lifelong friendship, you know,
definitely,
let alone everything else that came along with that relationship. Wow. Wow. Yeah. Oh my gosh, Dave.
Yeah.
Has anyone ever told you that you're a great storyteller?
I'm a good storyteller. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, yeah. You are.
Oh, good.
It's the creative in you, I think. Oh, and the playful personality.
Yeah. Don't forget that.
Yes. Well, I'd love to ask you the main question of the podcast, which is, I would so appreciate if you would share, you know, it could be one story, it could be two stories of something magical, miraculous, or mysterious that's happened in your life. You know, anything is up for grabs, whatever you feel like sharing.
This was about 2 years into my sobriety. I had the horse. I had just acquired the horse. I hadn't even had him a full year, and I was already training him to perform on a circus. And here's standard. I don't know if it's a standard for everybody, but standard for me was I actually signed the contract to perform in the spring of the year before I had the horse trained to do anything. So I, you know, kind of gave me a deadline. So then throughout the winter, I was training him to do the stuff, and I was financing this project with doing sign painting and artwork and stuff. And this lady brought me a big carnival trailer that she served ice cream and fruit cups, you know, sundaes and stuff. And she wanted this big elaborate scene, like a sidewalk scene with a lady pushing a fruit cart and a guy under, you know, sitting under an umbrella with a big waffle cone full of stuff and on either side of the serving window. And there was an umbrella on either side, you know, an umbrella over the table the guy was sitting at, an umbrella on top of the fruit cart. So it looked like a sidewalk scene. And I did an absolutely beautiful mural on the face of this thing. And she came, she loved it. She hooked onto it and she drug it away. And she went to her first event. And a couple of days later, she called me and said, "Hey, you know, the little spike that sticks out on the top of an umbrella?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Well, you forgot to paint one of them." So I went, "Oh, no." And it was like, what do I do now? So I found out where she was. I had to do the right thing. So I threw a ladder in the Volkswagen bus and drove up to the fairgrounds. And I explained to the guy at the gate what I was there to do. He let me in. I went and found where she was and unloaded the ladders, set it up in front of the thing, and climbed up with the brush and the paint. And it took about this long to paint the spike, about boop, and I was done. And when I came down off the ladder, this guy had ridden by on his bicycle and he had stopped. And he was looking at the scene and he saw me coming down off the ladder doing the finishing touch. And he said, "Would you come with me?" And I said, "Yeah." And I went with him. What was going on at the fairgrounds at the time was the RV Super Show. And he had just bought $1 million motorhome and he wanted his name painted on the front. Happy Hours. And so that was the happy accident that occurred that landed me in my next demographic. And for the next 20 years, my main gig was putting paintings on luxury motorhomes. And it all started as the result of a happy accident.
That is crazy.
That's exactly what happened.
I mean, first of all, I'm surprised that you missed the spike at the top of that umbrella, because you seem like someone who has a pretty profound attention to detail. But then, you know, you're so affable and kind, and you say, I'll come right over when she calls. I'll be right there. I'll be right there with a good attitude. You're not upset about it. You're not angry. You're like, I'll fix this. And because of that, it changed everything.
Everything. Definitely.
I did not even know there were such things as million-dollar RVs. Please forgive me for that. That is astounding. And so because you forgot to put the spike at the top of the umbrella, the rest of your life changed forever. That's really unreal.
Definitely. Yeah.
But also, I think what you're saying is, you know, this work that you did, it helped facilitate the work that you did with horses as well. Is that true?
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So horses, as you are well aware, they use horses for therapy. So it's interesting that here's this guy, he's probably experienced trauma as a kid because of the family situation, certainly confusion and frustration. And they use horses for therapy for juvenile delinquents and people that are in prison, and even people that are going through, what do you call it, therapy, physical therapy and different kinds of things. Horses have a lot of benefit. Even a horse that goes from room to room in a facility to monitor or greet or administer to the patients. Yeah. Because their horses are able to recognize somebody that needs attention. And they do exactly like Mr. Mischievous did. They just come over there and just stick their head on your shoulder.
Oh, my gosh.
Because of that that intuition that they have. Oh, here's somebody that needs me. You know? And yeah. And it's amazing that they don't have to do much, and it's therapeutic. Yeah.
Would you agree with the statement that each horse has its own personality?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. And when you study the politics of the herd, there are different roles that the horses will move into. There's an alpha, and then you've got the beta, and then you've got the different, depending on the size of the herd. And there's even the scapegoat at the bottom. And the same thing with a wolf pack. You know, the wolf family, not more than a family, just the pack, you know, the community of wolves. They have the same kind of, there's a hierarchy that exists. And yeah, definitely with horses too. And that's what happens with the little mule. I had that little mule her entire life. I put her down when she was 34. And we had connected, we had bonded, you know. And there are things that take place in the herd where the animals will bond and connect and do like, yeah, you were experiencing in that during that 2-hour interview. I just love horses. Yeah.
They seem, I mean, quite honestly, really heart-centered and really wise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm sure that you would say it was a huge gift to work with them.
Definitely. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've actually also met multiple people. Well, here in Santa Fe, lots of people that I've met keep mules, you know, and I wasn't really familiar with mules very mm-hmm. much. And I know that they each have their own personality, of course, uh-huh. as well.
Oh, yeah.
But a friend of mine was saying what a stinker her mule was, and that he'd figured out how to open the gate. And so he would then lead everyone else out and she would have to, you know, neighbors would be calling and saying, hey, just to let you know, they're all running around the neighborhood together and they're having fun, but he had figured it out. Totally brilliant mule. And I don't know if that's par for the course for mules, but he was a little stinker, troublemaker.
That horse of mine was able to, he was like a Houdini. He would figure out how to open the latch of the stall door. He'd lean down there and start playing with it with his mouth. And the next thing you know, he had it open. He'd push the door open, go outside. Never went very far, but he would do that.
Probably. Do you think it was from watching you?
Oh, probably. Yeah. Just figuring it out. Yep.
Just like the rest of us.
Yep.
If you're listening to the long form interview, to the sweet little Easter egg that I've got at the end of this outro, I need to thank Dave for appearing on the podcast and for being an absolute badass. I actually interviewed him earlier this week, and I was so enchanted with our conversation that I thought, I cannot wait to release this. So here we are, just a few days later, and the magic that is Dave. There's going to be links to all sorts of goodies in the episode show notes, but especially that YouTube video with the performance with his beloved mule. I need to thank Dave for coming on the show, and I need to thank all of you for listening each and every week. Don't forget to share this podcast with everyone you love, and then maybe after that, everyone that you can sort of semi-tolerate in your life. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Dave. Jump off the cliff. I mean, honestly, he knew as a kid that he wanted to join the circus. And I mean, that's something that I said as a kid. But as I said, no circuses came to my town and I didn't really have the opportunity. But Dave fell in love with the circus. And he knew, it's almost like he knew that it was going to be a part of his future. And so he's lived a life that is authentic, and maybe you would describe it as outside of society's norms. And I think we need more brave, brilliant individuals like this. So be like Dave and think about your life, or maybe just meander by a circus and consider joining, or whatever your type of circus looks like. Consider jumping off the cliff and living a brave and authentic life and creating even more magic in this world.
Dave, thanks so much for coming on the show. This interview has just been the cherry on top of the sundae that's today.
Oh, good. I've actually gotten some good news for all your listeners.
Yes, say it.
I've one of my books is called Hit the Road and Thrive, 7 Secrets for Living the Dream. And it was the result of being inspired by one of my customers who said, Dave, you are living the life, doing what you love, making people happy with what you do, living on the road, living an adventure, and you're being successful at it. You should write a book on how to do that. So I did. And so this is kind of a guidebook for people to encourage them to step forward into the unknown, you know, take a risk, be happy, you know, adopt that playful attitude that gives us that gives us the byproducts of joy, happiness, and useful purpose in things. And I've created an opportunity for your listeners to receive an download of the book. They can read absolutely free. All they have to do is go to the website, daveletterfly.com. And there's a place to put your email address and you can get the download and start reading it right away.
Oh my gosh, that's so generous.
I just want to help people.
Yeah.
It's made for people who are maybe sitting on their couch and they don't know what to do.
Right.
I just want to give them a leg up and, you know, and help them get on the way, because that's really where we, get it is when we start helping others.
Oh yeah. And I think a lot of times for me, what's just changed my life or helped me to evolve or become something other is witnessing other people and how they do it. Mm-hmm. It's, I kind of need to see an example of other human beings taking a chance or having an adventure or trying something new. And then I feel brave about it too.
Uh-huh.
So you're kind of a Wunderkind at all levels, I have to say. I'm sure you've heard that before. I mean,
I'm just on all the time.
I love that. I love that.